Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. This is Bill Redway and I'm bringing you the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday, 19th of January. Following my usual theme of introducing you to some music from the many talented folk performers in the country, this week I'm playing a track by our new young trio called Solasta. It's from their debut album, also called Solasta, and the name of the track is simply Reels. The instrumentation is slightly unusual in having a fiddle, a guitar, and a cello. As usual, I'll play it in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the Hearts Advertiser. That's the edition published on the 17th of January. And we follow that with suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days. Courtesy of Sue, once again. In part two, we have two stories from December's Hearts Life magazine. The first of these is called The Scandal of the Georgians and involves a baron, a prince, the baron's wife, and the White Hart Inn in St Albans. The second story is about Vincent van Gogh and a visit he made to England in 1873 to see his sister, who lived in the village of Wellin. We start with the news, and our readers today are Hilary, Sarah, Joan and Liz.
Hello there, this is Hilary, and my first story is about the founder of It's OK to Say campaign, who will be scaling new heights as part of her drive to promote better mental health. Anxiety specialist Stacey Turner, who's 40, will be embarking on a trip up Kilimanjaro on June the 14th, with the dual aim of highlighting the campaign and raising funds for Cancer Research UK. She launched the It's OK to Say initiative in partnership with the Hearts Advertiser last October to encourage people of all ages to speak out about mental illness, confide in others and surround themselves with supportive networks. It's currently applying for charity status. Stacey explained why she has decided to tackle Africa's highest mountain. I'm mostly doing this for anyone out there who has struggled with cancer, for those that have lost loved ones to cancer, to honour them and acknowledge our feelings and emotions surrounding such turmoil. I can't help but feel emotional every time I think of what I'm doing and why. We all have a story. My journey entails personal growth in the hope it will be freeing. I will be carrying the essence of those I have loved and lost up with me, while being grateful for those in my life and the light they bring. The mother of two daughters, who lives in St Albans, was inspired to climb the 16,000 feet mountain after watching the Comic Relief Ascent in 2009 and will be joined by her friend Claire Delaney, who works as a fundraising manager for Crook. She said, "I lost my beautiful nan to cancer 6 years ago and know many that have suffered the heartache throughout treatment and understand the devastating impact for those dealing with such loss. For inspiration, I recently watched the Comic Relief Ascent. I was in tears, yet it gave me such great insight into what to expect, some helpful tips and advice. It made me realise I need to raise some extra money for charity to supply mosquito nets. While we won't have the team the celebrities did, I'm sure as a team we will pull each other through. My main concerns are altitude sickness and the effects of the altitude plus exhaustion. I'm scared. It's going to be tough and grueling, and I will desperately miss my girls." For Stacey, the next few months will involve extensive training, including running, reformer Pilates, boxing, cycling and weights, plus nutritional changes. She's also using visualisation techniques to help prepare mentally for the climb up the tallest freestanding mountain in the world. She's excited about the 8-day challenge. "I'm looking forward to honouring and highlighting the importance of mental health. It's going to be awful and hard, yet quite something. A test of my strength, both physically and mentally, through the tough conditions and extreme weather and freezing nights. I'm doing it with an amazing team of people. The camaraderie will make all the difference, and emotionally, all with different reasons for the climb, I'm sure together we will conquer and take on what Kili gives us, most likely an impressive impact and change to our lives." Claire added, "I'm delighted that Stacey has joined this year's trek to Kilimanjaro, raising vital life-saving funds for Crook. She is also able to highlight her own charity and the amazing work she's doing in the area of mental health. Stacey is currently seeking donations, a goal of £4,000 for Crook, required to undertake the trip, and a goal of £2,000 for It's OK to Say. Stacey and Claire would also love sponsorship for their kit, which includes backpacks, clothing, footwear, minus 29 degrees centigrade extreme limit sleeping bags and walking poles from an explorer or outdoor company.
Hi, this is Liz. My first story is on Brexit, and it's entitled Brexit's Future is Uncertain as PM's Deal is Defeated. Parliament has rejected the Prime Minister's Brexit deal in a defeat which will go down in history. A meaningful vote on the terms of Britain's exit from the European Union lost 432 to 202 votes on Tuesday, the biggest defeat of a government motion in 100 years. St Albans MP Anne Main voted with the majority against the withdrawal agreement, as expected, sticking to her guns that the document threatens the union of our country. She took issue with the contentious Irish backstop, which would see an indefinite customs border drawn through the Irish Sea if future negotiations with the EU are not resolved before December 2022. Mrs. Main said, "The Irish government have confirmed that they will not put up a hard border, and the UK have continuously said that they would not put one up either. So I do not see the need for a backstop mechanism. I would prefer an orderly exit from the EU under a formal treaty arrangement, but if the European Commission are unwilling to budge on this issue, then I see no other alternative than us leaving the EU with a clean break, trading under World Trade Organization terms." For those arguing for a second referendum, they should ask themselves why any of the British people would bother to participate in the electoral process when the biggest electoral mandate in our history has been ignored. On the other hand, Hitchin and Harpenden MP Bim Afolami voted to approve the withdrawal agreement. "We now have to address the reality that in only 72 days we will crash out of the EU without a deal. No deal would mean massive disruption for the City of London, immediate limitations on our trade capabilities, and most importantly, would threaten the integrity of our United Kingdom. I will now be working hard with colleagues across political parties to come to a balanced solution that will protect business, provide certainty, and deliver on the result of the referendum." In June 2016, St Albans District voted 62.7% to remain. And since then, groups have sprung up to reverse the result and campaign for a people's vote. Residents have been contacting the Hearts Ad to give their opinion on Brexit. Richard Homer said, "She, Anne Main, is so far out of touch with her constituents. A reminder that 63% of St Albans voted to remain in the EU, that it's time she started representing the will of the people, as Anne puts it, by doing what she can to prevent this disaster for St Albans happening." He said St Albans voters will remember her position at the next election. Sarah Llewellyn Jones said, "When faced with an important decision, most people would ask themselves more than once, do they still want to go through with it, at every stage of the process? A sensible person wouldn't instigate massive change without checking that they still really wanted to go through with it. The result of the referendum was Leave, a massive change." She compared leaving the EU with buying a new house, highlighting once all the information about a property is available, the buyer can pull out of the sale. Adding, "What is everyone frightened of with the second vote? That people may exercise their right to change their mind? Some Remainers may now vote to leave, and some Brexiteers may now vote to remain. We have an idea of what Brexit looks like now, and how long it will take for the UK to untangle itself from the EU. Surely a second vote is democracy in full flow. Democracy is about choice, isn't it?" Phil Fletcher said, "The obvious basic fact that absolutely nobody on this earth can make a sound decision without being adequately informed is consistently ignored. If a no-deal Brexit does happen, and it does turn out to be as bad as many fear, then it is arguable that the British electorate has been the victim of a right-wing media in the control of a few."
Hi, I'm Joan. Miserable council flat tenants are battling an infestation of mould which is covering their beds, walls and belongings. When Natalie Jones, Alan Stevens and their three children moved into a St Albans council house on Thirlstane, Lemsford Road, 6 months ago, they noticed a small amount of mould in a bedroom. The problem grew from there, and black fungus now covers 50% of every wall in the house, soaking the family's bedsheets with damp and making them feel unwell. 3-month-old Harley has been hospitalised with bronchitis twice since moving in. 10-year-old Morgan has asthma. 6-year-old Rhiannon is disturbed by sleep apnea. And Natalie suffers with postnatal depression and anxiety. Natalie said her doctors advised the family that all of these conditions have been caused by or worsened by the mould. She has had to throw away the children's soft toys and belongings when they have been ruined by mould. Natalie added, "The property is affecting our health. My anxiety and depression has gone through the roof, and I haven't had it this bad in years." She feels that St Albans District Council has not done enough to fix the problem, despite her reporting it 5 months ago. "The council just aren't listening and aren't helping us. I have even contemplating telling the council to shove their tenancy, but I can't do that because I'm not making myself and my kids homeless. The kids hate it. They don't like living here either. It is awful. I have lived in St Albans for 11 years and I have never been so miserable. It's affecting all our lives. It is disgusting. No matter where we go, we have to look at mould and wet." Head of Housing at St Albans District Council, Karen Dragovic, said, "We are concerned this family have a major condensation problem at their home and we have been working with them to find a solution. Our repairs team and a damp contractor carried out inspections shortly after being made aware of the issue, and we've kept the tenants fully informed of our proposed actions." She said St Albans District Council has commissioned a number of works, such as fan installation, anti-mould wash and stain block to the ceilings and walls. She added, "We offered to house the tenants elsewhere for around 6 days while this extensive work was carried out, but did not reach a satisfactory agreement. We're now talking to our contractor to see if it is possible to undertake the work while the property is occupied."
Hello, I'm Sarah with an article about the City Library. The first phase of a refurbishment has been completed at St Albans Library as part of a programme of improvements. Herts County Council is developing the library so that there's more room for reading, a bookable meeting room, better Wi-Fi and a new creative space for users. The back of the library was closed during the refurbishment and reopened last Thursday. A County Council spokeswoman said, "The current work, which has just been completed, is the first phase of a major refurbishment and modernisation of St Albans Central Library. It's seen the back of the library fitted with new shelving, a new children's area and new carpets, and the whole library is also being rewired. The reopening of the back of the library has enabled the council to reintroduce the popular baby rhyme time and toddler tale sessions." The spokeswoman explained, "Once this space reopens, phase two will commence with the front of the library temporarily closed for approximately 2 months. During this time, new carpets and shelving will be installed and the ceiling will be replaced. The new creator space, giving people of all ages the chance to get creative, will be developed as well as the installation of green screen technology for people who are interested in vlogging and blogging and special effects. The newly refurbished and modernised library is expected to be formally launched in May. A temporary library is in place in the same space at the Maltings while the second phase of development is underway." Herts County Council's Cabinet Member for Libraries, Terry Duris, said, "We appreciate users' patience whilst this work is carried out. We're extremely proud of our libraries and St Albans Library is one of our most popular and well used. The work that we're carrying out will provide a wide range of services and facilities and I'm sure that the improvements to the library will create an exciting, flexible space for the benefit of all. Control of Hertfordshire Libraries will likely be handed over to an outside provider by autumn of this year to make savings of £500,000 from library budgets, without impacting planned improvements."
A cancer unit and Macmillan will benefit from £2,000 raised at a London Coney quiz night. District Councillor Drida Gordon and former Parish Councillor Clerk Irene Casper organised the quiz night after surviving breast cancer. Councillor Gordon said, "We both had treatment at Mount Vernon Cancer Care Unit, and we had such wonderful support from the staff there who were so caring and understanding, as it's quite scary being diagnosed with cancer. The Macmillan nurses were always there at the end of a phone if you had any questions about the treatment or any concerns. They made it as bearable as they possibly could. Even though the experience was pretty awful, the support from different agencies was wonderful. We want to give something back so they can be in place for other people." The quiz was held at the Caledon Community Centre in London Coney last October. Drida Gordon and Irene Casper handed over a cheque for £1,000 to Mount Vernon at Lister Hospital in Stevenage in December, and they have received a certificate from Macmillan for donating the other £1,000 to them. Macmillan's fundraising manager for Hertfordshire, Georgia Clark, said, "I would like to extend my sincere thanks to Drida and Irene for hosting a quiz night in aid of the charity and donating a fantastic £1,000. The funds, raised as a result of people's generosity, could help to provide vital financial support to local people living with cancer through our Hertfordshire Macmillan Benefits Advice Service. Macmillan's research shows 4 out of 5 people are, on average, £570 worse off each month because of a cancer diagnosis. People can often feel reluctant to apply for financial support and may find the application process lengthy or confusing. Our trained financial advisors provide free, confidential guidance, information and support to help soften the financial blow for people affected by cancer, their families and carers." A spokesperson for East and North Hertfordshire Hospitals charity, which run Mount Vernon, said, "We are extremely grateful to both Drida and Irene for their generosity. Donations like this make a huge impact on patients and their families, allowing us to fund the very best medical equipment, research, staff training and facilities."
Townsfolk will soon have a chance to guide the direction of housing, employment, infrastructure, transport and green space protection for the next 15 years of Harpenden development. Next month, Harpenden residents have a chance to approve or block the town's 2018 to 2033 Neighbourhood Plan, NP, which has been put together by an NP steering group made up of community representatives, Harpenden Town Council and Harpenden Rural Parish Council. In making the document, the steering group has been informed by 3,625 survey responses in 3 rounds of community engagement. If adopted, the NP ensures that 25% of the community infrastructure levy from new developments is spent on Harpenden, on projects such as affordable housing, community facilities, and public transport infrastructure. St Albans District Council, SADC, will also be obliged to consider the document in all Harpenden planning applications. Covering both Harpenden and Kingsbourne Green, it includes proposals to build a minimum of 23 affordable houses on the former Westfield allotment site, 14 homes each at Pan Auto Services and Dewson on Grove Road, and 34 homes at Harpenden Memorial Hospital. The South Down Industrial Estate is protected as a key employment location. Community Representative Nicola Wyeth, who helped to draft the document, said, "The main thing is it is written by the people of the town, and it means we, as a town, have a say on the future of Harpenden. It can't prevent future developments that the higher levels of government might impose, but it can change them so they fit with the vision of the town that people have told us." She stressed that the referendum has nothing to do with Brexit and is separate to the St Albans local plan, currently being drafted by SADC. The votes will take place on February the 7th from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. at polling stations around Harpenden. At Woodend School, Crabtree School, All Saints Church Hall, Batford Memorial Hall, Park Hall, St John's Church Hall, Harpenden Public Halls, and St Nicholas Church Hall.
We may only be a couple of weeks into 2019, but Rennie Grove Hospice Care is already seeking participants for this year's Hearts 10K, which takes place in Harpenden on Sunday, the 13th of October. Tracy Hancock, Director of Fundraising at Rennie Grove, said, "Booking your place now means you can take advantage of the early bird discounted entry fee and gives you plenty of time to train and get friends and family to support you. All entry fees include race entry, a technical T-shirt, a finisher's medal, chip timing and water en route." The Hearts 10K is Rennie Grove's biggest fundraising event each year. It provides a great opportunity to join with thousands of others to complete the course whilst experiencing a wonderful feeling of community and lots of support along the route, Tracy added. 2018 headline sponsors of the Hearts 10K, Harpenden-based Ploughman Craven, entered a team of runners in 2018. Peter Folwell, who is a director at the surveying company, explained that there was a lot more to their involvement than sponsorship. He said, "A big group of us at Ploughman Craven trained as part of a health and well-being initiative. We wanted to promote a healthy lifestyle for our team and our continued support for Rennie Grove, and the Hearts 10K was a great way to round off that initiative. If you want to experience the unique atmosphere and camaraderie of participating in the Hearts 10K challenge with thousands of others, whilst raising much-needed funds to support Rennie Grove's 24/7 hospice at home service, then visit www.hearts10k.com and book your place now. Good luck."
Centre 33 means no vulnerable person should ever go hungry in St Albans City. Did you know there's a warm place in the heart of St Albans where everyone's welcome to eat a cooked breakfast and hot evening meal free of charge? Open 7 days a week, Centre 33 is located on Spicer Street and provides practical support to the city's streets homeless and socially deprived. It has two dining areas to ensure that vulnerable people need never go hungry and is manned and managed almost entirely by over 100 volunteers. In 2018, the centre served 8,724 meals, served to approximately 300 individuals over the course of the year. Visitor Rachel Burroughs, 27, said, "This is the best restaurant in town. It saves lives. Without this, people would starve or get done for nicking from shops." Dawn Martin, 53, agreed, "It's a lifesaver for some people. They don't just provide food, they give help and warmth to people who don't get it anywhere else." Trustee Peter Graham said he had a long-term interest in homelessness, but he says he only really got involved practically in his 50s. "I quickly saw how Centre 33 met the practical needs of people in St Albans who were sleeping rough, sofa surfing or otherwise needed help. I soon came to realise that Centre 33 provided more than just hot food and drink. It was very welcoming and non-judgmental." Volunteer Rachel LeGrew Christmas said she loved working there. "I volunteered at Centre 33 for 10 years. It makes me feel part of the community. The visitors are very friendly. I have such a great time chatting to them, and it's a privilege to be there, especially at holiday times when people have nowhere else to go. Opening hours are 10:30 a.m. to noon, weekday mornings, and 8 till 9:30 p.m, Monday to Thursday evenings. They are also open Saturdays from 12:30 till 2 p.m, and Sundays from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Councillor Brian Ellis, portfolio holder for housing and inclusion at St Albans District Council, said, "We work in partnership with Centre 33, as well as other organisations, to help the homeless and other disadvantaged people. Their drop-in centres offer warmth, free food and company in a welcoming and supportive atmosphere, helping people who are often socially isolated or living on the streets.
The campaign group Save St Albans Pubs met with MP Anne Main on Monday to talk about the impact of business rates on pubs. Representatives attended a meeting with Mrs Main and the Exchequer Secretary to the Treasury, Robert Jenrick, MP, to urge the government to review pubs' business rates. The business rate relief announced by the Chancellor in his October budget provides a third off business rates for businesses with a rateable value of £51,000 or below. However, this reduction has not helped the majority of pubs in St Albans, who have seen an increase in their business rates. Sean Hughes, who coordinates the group and is landlord of The Boot, Dillon's and The Plough in Sleepside, travelled to London alongside Christo Tafali from Ye Olde Fighting Cocks, Alan Oliver from The Six Bells and Mandy McNeil, who runs St Albans Tastes Limited, to make the case for pubs in St Albans. They told the Treasury Minister the announced cut in rates had not helped St Albans and had the opposite effect, putting future pressure on their businesses. Speaking after the meeting, Mrs Main said, "Save St Albans Pubs made an excellent case to the Minister. The government has to realise that this formula for calculating the rates has not helped to support local businesses and pubs in high-value areas like St Albans. The system of taxing turnover and high property value has meant that the aim of the cut will not help in areas like mine. I hope the Minister will engage with pubs in my constituency and the Treasury will consider offering a one-third cut on rates up to the first £51,000. The current cliff edge of businesses with a rate of over £51,000 has not helped the many great pubs in St Albans. Ultimately, the whole system needs to be reviewed, but as a first step, I would urge the Minister to consider the one-third cut." Mrs Main committed to raising the issue in Parliament after a visit to many St Albans pubs in November and secured a debate in Parliament this week on the negative impact business rate reform has had in St Albans. Since the rates increase in 2017, The Boot saw an increase in business rates of 280%, The Blacksmith's Arms 82%, The Beach House 59%, Dillon's 32%, Ye Olde Fighting Cocks 60% and The Six Bells 87%. More than 30 pubs have been affected and collectively they will need to sell around 180,000 pints per year to cover the hike.
A group of St Albans friends stepped up to the challenge of raising money for the homeless with a daily 5K run. Every day in December 2017, Caroline Young jogged 5K around the streets of St Albans to collect almost £1,500 for Centre 33. For December 2018, she was joined in the same challenge by three of her friends, Harriet Fleming, Harriet Bailey and Rachel Ferrer. They have already collected about £3,000 for the charity, which provides a drop-in centre for homeless and disadvantaged people in Spicer Street. Caroline said, "Last year I did it on my own, and this year I thought I really wanted to do it again. I was talking to my friends about it, and they said they wanted to do it too." Three of them completed the challenge, and Rachel only stopped because she sprained her ankle on a dark early morning run. Rachel is going to make up the last 6 days once her injury is healed. Caroline added, "It was great. I have to say it was less cold than last year. Last year we had a week of snow in the middle of the month. It was only easier in that I knew I could do it. It was not easier in terms of exertion at the time and aching muscles, but mentally I knew I could do it." She said the group tried to run together early in the morning to fit around work, but sometimes that was not possible. "It was hard work because obviously finding time in the day and having aching legs by the end of the month, it was becoming a real challenge. By Christmas, the group were all in different places," Caroline said, "and at one point she had to find a route in Germany." She added, "I am going to do something else next year. Not sure what it will be, but I need to do something that will be equally challenging."
The cold, dark January mornings can easily leave us feeling sluggish, sleepy, and lacking in the get up and go we need to tackle the day. The good news is that you don't need a bursting bank balance to kickstart your winter mojo, and you don't need to rely on cup after cup of coffee either. There are so many cost-effective ways to raise spirits and restore smiles as 2019 gets underway, says Liz Earle, founder of Liz Earle Wellbeing. Looking after our well-being shouldn't mean spending lots of money on the latest fads. Here, Earle shares her top five budget-bursting tips for keeping your energy levels up until spring rolls in. 1. Add a dose of whole homemade probiotics into your diet. A daily dose of probiotics can make a real difference to gut health and therefore our overall health and well-being. However, shop-bought probiotics in the form of plain live yogurt and kombucha, or fermented foods such as kefir and pickled vegetables, can be expensive and full of added sugar. Why not try making your own instead? You'll be surprised how easy and cost-effective this is. Live yogurt is so easy to make overnight with a little milk, and I always have kombucha ferment, a type of fizzy tea, on the go in my kitchen. Her second suggestion, introduce a pocket of stillness into your day. Last year, I travelled through Sardinia and Greece to investigate blue zones, special regions where people share a common lifestyle whose exceptional longevity has been verified. One of the key learnings that has stayed with me is how weaving pockets of still into our day can have a hugely beneficial impact on our well-being. There are a variety of ways to do this, such as meditation or relaxing walks, and all of them are free. Her third suggestion, stretch daily. One of the easiest ways to knock years off how you look and feel is to make a real effort to improve posture, and it's never too late to start. By standing truly upright, feet flat on the ground, head looking straight ahead, shoulders back and lowered, you immediately feel more alive. Fourth suggestion, give your gut time to rest. It's really important to allow our body and therefore our gut to rest from time to time. Whenever possible, try to rest your gut overnight, allowing a clear 12-hour window when nothing is eaten. I try to have a little juice cleanse at least twice a year too. Her fifth suggestion, spend more time outside. Natural daylight and fresh air increase our sense of well-being and happiness, so don't let the cold weather stop you from getting outside at this time of year. Whether it's a leisurely stroll in the park or a brisk walk to a meeting, being outside can lift our moods, ease anxiety, and wake up a sluggish mind. I'm a recent convert to running and enjoy early morning runs around my West Country farm or at the park near my office when I'm in London.
Permanent CCTV will not be installed along a notorious crime-ridden pathway in St Albans. During a discussion about safety concerns along the Alban Way, St Albans District Council, SADC, heard last week that putting up permanent cameras would breach a national code of practice. This is because there's not enough criminal behaviour reported to substantiate a pressing need. However, a petition calling for action has garnered more than 1,200 signatories. It said, if there was CCTV down the Alban Way, the community would feel safer and these offenders will not continue to get away with these crimes. There have been numerous incidents where people have been experiencing violence, threats, theft and more while walking or cycling down the Alban Way. In one incident, a group of teens threw stones at a jogger, and in another, partially filmed and attached to the petition, a man was pushed off his bike and assaulted. On January the 10th, SADC's Community Safety Working Group heard that although temporary cameras had been installed at a known trouble spot, the junction with Hill End Lane, there was no authority for permanent use. The equipment would also cost £505,000. Lighting the pathway at a cost of £500,000 plus continued maintenance was also discussed. The working group asked portfolio holder for business and the community, Councillor Salai Gai-Gassouz, to investigate the options further. He will submit a report of his findings to the Community Environment and Sports Scrutiny Committee on March the 7th. Councillors also asked Hearts Police to patrol the Alban Way as a priority. Chair of both the Working Group and Scrutiny Committee, Councillor Anthony Rowland, said, "The petition shows there's widespread concern that the Alban Way, one of our most treasured community assets, has become unsafe, particularly at night. There may not be strong enough case for installing CCTV, but clearly we should investigate other effective measures, working with the local community to ensure that pedestrians, cyclists, joggers and dog walkers can make use of the Alban Way without fear of being attacked or abused."
Men can participate alongside women in the St Albans Race for Life for the first time ever this year. Cancer Research UK is opening up the historically women's only event for 2019, inviting men, women and children to take part in the 5K or 10K route around Verulamium Park. Cancer Research UK's St Albans event manager, Annie Ashwell, said, "Our Race for Life events have been women only since they started over 25 years ago. But now we feel the time is right to open them up, so that everyone, women, men and children, has the chance to participate together. One in two people in the UK will be diagnosed with cancer at some point during their lifetime. Sadly, this means nearly everyone is touched by the disease, either directly or through a loved one or friend. To make a significant difference in the fight against cancer, we need to harness as much energy and commitment as possible. So what better way than involving everyone in the community in our events? Race for Life events around the country raise millions for Cancer Research UK every year. The money is invested in research to fight 200 types of cancer. Annie described the yearly event as fun, colourful, emotional and uplifting. The Race for Life is a powerful, inspirational movement which unites participants in St Albans with people across Hertfordshire and the whole of the UK. Taking part in our Race for Life events enables like-minded people to get together and remember loved ones lost to cancer or celebrate the lives of those who have survived. At the same time, they are helping to make a difference to people with cancer right now. This January, we're urging mums, dads, nans, grandpas, brothers, sisters, friends and workmates to show their support by joining the Race for Life. It's a perfect example of everyday people doing an extraordinary thing, uniting in a common cause to beat cancer. The St Albans event, in partnership with Tesco, takes place on July the 21st. Sign up in January with the code RFL30 to get a 30% discount off entry fees. Details are on the Race for Life website.
A long-awaited new sport and cultural centre in Harpenden has been given the green light. Although the £18.8 million scheme had been given conditional planning permission by St Albans District Council, the project had been sent to the Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government for ultimate consideration. This is because the site is on Greenbelt land and therefore needs authorisation from central government. The proposals include multiple swimming pools, a sports hall, dance studio, larger gym, steam room and sauna at Rothampstead Park. It would also include an arts and cultural centre next door with an exhibition space, bars and a cafe and a 511-seat theatre named after comedy legend and former Harpenden resident Eric Morecambe. Planning casework manager Simon Haydecker-Dent had said there are no objections to the plan and SADC can start work on the project. Mr. Haydecker-Dent said, "The government is committed to give more power to councils and communities to make their own decisions on planning issues and believes planning decisions should be made at the local level wherever possible. Designs were shaped by extensive public consultations and work is due to start in the spring. SADC's portfolio holder for commercial and development, Councillor Julian Daly, said this development will add to the portfolio of sports centre redevelopments under the council's belt. This includes Batchwood, Cotswoldswick and Westminster Lodge in the last 6 years. He said, "The new sport and cultural centres will be high quality developments with the potential to enrich the lives of people in Harpenden of all ages and backgrounds. They will be valuable community assets." Portfolio holder for sport and culture, Councillor Annie Brewster, thanked the community. "There is palpable excitement to finally have the gym and swimming facilities under the same roof and modern, comfortable seating in the new Eric Morecambe Theatre. The approved designs will offer the people of Harpenden, Redbourne and Wheat Hampstead fantastic amenities to enjoy for years to come."
A letter from Nigel Green of the St Albans Quieter Skies. "On two occasions now, your newspaper has published an article referring to the reduction in noise complaints received by London Luton Airport, interpreted as meaning that the situation has improved. Unfortunately, nothing has been done to improve the situation. It has the potential to get very much worse, and there are other reasons for the reduction in complaints. Most reasonable people believe that having made a complaint, something will be done to address it. They have no wish to join that list of serial complainers much derided by the airport operators. Many individuals who are affected by the frequency of noise from the aircraft flying over us know that the CAA has yet to publish its final report on whether the airspace changes made in 2015 have delivered the desired objective. This report is overdue, but residents know that there will be no further changes until it is published, and so are patiently but expectantly waiting. Finally, but not insignificantly, anybody who now wishes to complain to the airport operator about noise from their flights and attempts to do so using the web-based Travis system is now met on the first screen with a very intimidating privacy notice. This notice, which must be accepted in order to proceed, says that in writing to the airport, they will collect personal data that will include details such as photographic images, vehicle registration number, dates of visit to the airport, medical records, and so on. It then goes on to list why they need this data and what they do with it. Our attempts to have this notice customised so that it matches the purpose intended have been ignored, and I have first-hand evidence that it has deterred residents from proceeding to register complaints. Nothing has been done to address the very significant rise in complaints following the last airspace change, and the prospect of a further doubling of flights using this route does not bear contemplation should the airport be allowed to expand further."
Recycling. St Albans Council is in sight of becoming one of the top 10 recycling local authorities in England. Newly released government figures for the year to the end of March 2018 show the council has jumped to 13th in a table of 350 local authorities. It moved up 13 places from last year, overtaking a host of other councils. The recycling rate hit 60.3% for the year to the end of May 2018. This was the first time the council reached its target, set in 2016, of 60+% in a 12-month period. This follows a campaign to encourage more food recycling, targeted at areas where take-up was relatively low. Councillor Francis Leonard said, "The new waste collection regime that was rolled out in the summer of 2016 continues to be a great success, thanks to the support of our residents. Recycling conserves resources, protects the environment, and saves the council taxpayers money, with landfill becoming increasingly expensive." And now some information about an organ concert to be held at the St Albans Cathedral this weekend. St Albans Cathedral's former Master of Music returns this Saturday to give a free recital. Colin Walsh, now organist of Lincoln's Cathedral, presents an all-French programme on January the 19th as part of the International Organ Festival's series of free Saturday concerts. He'll perform a mixture of popular favourites and lesser-known works by French composers from the late 19th and 20th centuries. Marcel Dupré's haunting Cortège et Litany opens the programme, followed by the second Fantaisie by Camille Saint-Saëns. César Franck's grand Pièce Héroïque reflects the spirit of the building where it was first performed, the Trocadéro Palace in Paris. Next is Franck's pupil Charles Tourémine, Fantaisie Improvisation sur l'Ave Marie Stella, a resplendent toccata. The stirring finale of Louis Vienne's Second Organ Symphony brings us back to earth, followed by Gaston Litaisi's beautifully proportioned lead. Finally, the St Albans audience will hear Henri Moulez's famous Carillon Sortie. The recital starts at 5:30 p.m. Admission is free, with a retiring collection in aid of St Albans International Organ Festival Society.
And here's a roundup of the radio listings for this week, the 19th of January to the 25th of January. On Saturday the 19th of January on Classic FM at 5 p.m. in Saturday Night at the Movies, Andrew Collins showcases previous winners of the Academy Award for Best Film Soundtrack ahead of the announcement of the 2019 awards on Tuesday, and also some that he felt should have won. Opera on 3 from the Met at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 3 is recorded live from the Metropolitan Opera in New York. It's a performance of Debussy's Pelléas et Mélande and is conducted by the Met's dynamic new musical director, Yannick Zetswin. On Radio 2 at 8 p.m, Johnny Walker begins a new series of 13 programmes showcasing the cream of rock from across the decades. Also at 8 p.m, but on Radio 4, Archive on 4 investigates fake news. Satirist Gareth Gwynne has been granted unprecedented access to the BBC archive and uses a combination of fact and fiction to tell the story of world-changing events that could have happened. And now for Sunday the 20th of January. At 11:15 a.m. on Radio 4, Lauren Laverne's Castaway on Desert Island Discs is James Rebanks, author of the memoir The Shepherd's Life. On Radio 3 at 6:45 p.m, the Sunday feature, Afterwards, is the second of three programmes exploring great writers' ideas as expressed in their own words. Today's instalment focuses on New York-born essayist, author and cultural theorist Susan Sontag. The BBC World Service has a fascinating programme about the beautiful bird the raven in Heart and Soul. Having been brought almost to extinction in the UK, writer Joe Shute, who is a fan of the bird, travels to the islands off the northwest coast of Canada, where it is held in high esteem by one of the tribes, and the recordings of the raven's calls are like something from another world. The programme is broadcast at 9:30 a.m. and 11:30 p.m.
A look now at programmes that run on each day through the week from Monday. The Book of the Week at 9:45 a.m. and repeated at 12:30 a.m. on Radio 4 FM is Made, an exploration of poverty in the modern Western world. Made is Stephanie Land's hope-inspiring and funny account of how she managed to juggle cleaning jobs and motherhood in a US tourist resort and to eventually become a journalist and teacher. The 15-minute drama on Radio 4 at 10:45 a.m. and repeated at 7:45 p.m. is The Misunderstanding by Irene Nemirovsky. The 1926 work, her debut novel, tells the compelling story of an affair between a troubled First World War veteran and a rich man's wife in southern France. Radio 3's Composer of the Week is Franz Liszt, 1811 to 86. Donald MacLeod delves into the life and work of the prolific composer and virtuoso pianist. On Radio 4 at 1:45pm, James Burke's Web of Knowledge is a new series with the renowned broadcaster and historian, revealing how the most unexpected connections can be made across history, beginning by linking Mozart to the helicopter. The essay on Radio 3 at 10:45pm is Yorkshire. Novelist Andrew Martin muses on the county of his birth and upbringing, beginning by thinking about his tyke identity as he sets off from London to York by train.
And some picks for each day of the week from Monday to Friday. On Monday the 21st of January, Searching for Swimming Pools is the radio feature article this week, and Alex Preston, an author and journalist, has made the programme because he received a copy of a book of a swimming memoir by Charles Spawson, titled Haunts of the Black Masseur. It was a bestseller in the 1990s, and he felt compelled in an act of homage to interview the author and celebrate his rich and complex life. On Tuesday, the 22nd of January, at 11am on Radio 4 in the Romanian Wave, Tessa Dunlop uncovers a misunderstood, multi-layered immigrant community and asks why so many Romanians now call Britain home. Great Lives on Radio 4 at 4:30pm is featuring the life and achievements of Freddie Mercury. Comedy actor Mac Lucas reflects on his nomination of the Queen frontman for the Great Life title together with Leslie Ann Jones, author of the award-winning biography Bohemian Rhapsody, especially with the success of the film of the same name. Jamie Cullen returns on Radio 2 at 9pm to showcase his love of jazz with guest musicians including Hugh Coltman. On Wednesday the 23rd of January, on Radio 4 at 2:15pm, drama presents Spike and the Elf in Oak. David Threlfall stars in Ian Billing's comic fantasy, inspired by the story of Spike Milligan's attempt in the mid-1960s to preserve the Elf in Oak sculpture in London's Kensington Gardens, while also performing in the West End run of his play The Bed-Sitting Room. When the theatre censors get in the way of Spike saving the elves, events threaten to spiral out of control. Radio 3 in Concert at 7:30pm is by the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Vasily Petrenko, who will be playing a popular selection of works by Grieg, Beethoven and Sibelius.
On Thursday the 24th of January, The Forum, The Heel in the Sneaker is on the BBC World Service at 9:05am. There's a shoe museum. It's in Toronto and it's shaped like a shoebox. It's about to be opened with a collection of 13,500 artefacts, including Marilyn Monroe's stilettos. Originally assembled by Sonia Barta, whose surname was once on shoe shops throughout the UK, the programme discusses the history of footwear. At 11am on Radio 4, Kate Adie returns for a new series of From Our Own Correspondent and presents reports from around the globe as BBC correspondents examine stories in their own regions. At 3pm on Radio 4, Open Country, Journey into Space in Sutherland. The Amoine Peninsula in the Scottish Highlands, a wilderness virtually unchanged since the Ice Age, has been chosen as the potential site of a spaceport that would launch small satellites at the rate of 3 a month. The programme hears from people on both sides of the debate of these plans. On Friday the 25th of January, on Radio 4 at 2:15, the drama is Hello Caller, written by Jonathan Holloway. This brilliant idea for a drama suggests that, with so many old telephone kiosks having been decommissioned, what would happen if voices from the past had become trapped in the decades of circuitry? This leads to an unconnected sequence of calls and voices from all different call boxes around the country. Some are comic, some are chilling. A strong cast brings the voices to life. Friday night is Music Night on Radio 2 at 8 p.m. Ken Bruce celebrates the lives and musics of two of the most influential singers and entertainers of the last century, Judy Garland, 1922-69, and Frank Sinatra, 1915-98.
Here are the names of people and their ages, if published, who have died recently and whose names are recorded in the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser. We hope they rest in peace and send condolences to their families. Alicia Sconcia, aged 78. Rachel Few, 61. Jean Rosser, 86. Alexander Richard Chalkley, 27. Paul Harold Perry, 75. Isabella Meyer Allen. Ursula Irwin, 82. Dorothy Jean Tillotson. Ferenc Kolacsi, 83.
Hello, I'm David, and I have here an article for you from the Hertfordshire Life magazine of November 2018. It's called The Scandal of the Georgians. 250 years ago this month, a baron's servant smashed down a bedroom door in St Albans' White Hart Inn to find a prince in bed with his master's wife. Cue a court case, a delighted press, and much airing of royal underwear. The words are by Michael Long. On one of the main roads north out of London, in an era before trains and automobiles, the 70 inns of St Albans were always busy. One of the most important was the White Hart on Holywell Hill. Built in the 15th century, on the site of a hospital caring for pilgrims to St Albans Abbey, the inn witnessed the bloody dynastic conflict of the Wars of the Roses that began in the town in 1455, and in the centuries to follow, countless more stories, mostly forgotten in the passage of time. But 250 years ago, an event too scandalous to remain secret thrust this provincial inn onto the front pages of the London press. The tale of the illicit liaison between Prince Henry, younger brother of George III, and his lover, Lady Henrietta Grosvenor, wife of one of the wealthiest men in England, had the country gripped. Henry, known as Harry, was Duke of Cumberland and Strathearn, sixth child of the Prince of Wales and a 23-year-old bachelor in the autumn of 1768 when he met Henrietta, the young wife of Baron Grosvenor. Hers was an unhappy marriage. Her husband Richard, who owned much of Mayfair, had a notorious reputation for gambling and frequenting the seedier parts of London, enjoying the rougher types of brothel in Drury Lane. The society beauty, longing for love and affection, and the smitten young prince came together, beginning an affair in November 1768. They had few opportunities to be alone together and corresponded through love letters, often in French, written in lemon juice, which became legible with heat. "I love you more than life," wrote Harry early in 1769. Henrietta replied, amid the danger of being caught, "He is coming upstairs, so I shall conclude." Lady Grosvenor was living her other life as a dutiful wife, regularly travelling between the family estates in Cheshire and Mayfair. En route, she would meet the prince at the White Hart, always staying in the best room. Henrietta believed that her husband knew nothing of the affair. But she was wrong. The baron had discovered his wife's liaison by intercepting letters, copying them, resealing and forwarding them on. Divorce in Georgian England was difficult and required an act of parliament. But if Richard could obtain in flagrante evidence, he could pursue a suit of separation from bed and board, allowing him legal separation and the ability to sue the prince for criminal conversation, for wounding his property through adultery. In law, Henrietta was considered a chattel, the legal property of her husband. The courts, however, cared little about her husband's infidelity, so Henrietta could not use the baron's brothel visits as grounds to leave the marriage. On December the 15th, 1769, Prince Harry sent his trusted manservant, Robert Giddings, to Cheshire to ask Henrietta to meet him at the White Hart. Whichever of them arrived first was to book adjoining bedrooms. 6 days later, while her husband stayed in Cheshire, Henrietta made her way to London, arriving in St. Albans before the prince and booking two interconnected rooms overlooking Holywell Hill. Having settled in, she dismissed her servants. Meanwhile, Matthew Stevens, the baron's under-butler and someone Henrietta trusted, sneaked upstairs and quietly drilled two spy holes in her bedroom door. Stevens had been tasked by the baron to get the damning evidence against her that he needed. Henrietta dined alone and withdrew to her room. Harry, in disguise, arrived with Giddings, who went upstairs and marked the door of the room adjoining Henrietta's with chalk. The prince entered from a rear door. The inn's ostler would later say the man looked furtive. At 9 in the evening, Stevens brought Henrietta a drink to check to see if she was alone. 2 hours later, he again made his way upstairs, this time bringing with him a horde of witnesses, his brother Jack, a coachman, 6 other servants, and the inn's owner, Mrs. Langford. Stevens peered through the spy holes, but although he could see most of the room, the corner where the bed was hidden from view. Frustrated and knowing that his master wanted incontrovertible evidence of adultery, Stephen decided to break down the door. In the attic room above, the prince's manservant, awoken by the noise, rushed downstairs. Inside the bedroom, Stevens and his crew found Henrietta frantically buttoning her dress. She ran for the broken door, but tripped over her skirts, which the witnesses later said were much disturbed. The prince, whose own clothing was described in much disarray, also made for the door, but his way was barred by the group of onlookers. "Do you not know who I am?" the prince roared. The witnesses replied, "Yes, your Royal Highness." Thinking on his feet, he told them he had never been in Henrietta's room, but had rushed from the adjoining one to her aid when he heard the door being smashed. Stevens asked Mrs. Langford and servants to examine the bedclothes. The servants later testified that the bed was much tumbled from top to bottom, and all the bedclothes being much rumpled. Stevens testified in court that he could hear rustlings and amorous noises, and was sure the lovers were in bed together. Days after Christmas, 1769, with the press champing at the bit to report the publicly known story, the Lord Chamberlain forbade the reporting of any story involving a member of the royal family, on pain of prosecution for libel. The London newspapers, of which there were more than 60 at the time, landed on a solution, reporting, "A much talked-of assignation between the D of C and Lady G." In the spring, Baron Grosvenor issued a writ against Prince Henry and sent the anti-monarchy Middlesex Journal all the copies of the love letters he had intercepted. Their publication was a huge embarrassment to the crown and was lapped up by everyone else. Henrietta was not finished, however. When the case came to court, she defended herself by exposing her husband's gambling and womanising. Witnesses from London brothels testified to the baron's peculiar behaviour. The newspapers loved it, reporting every word from court, minus names, as the scandal became the talk of London and far beyond. The evidence was hugely revealing, as every detail about the prince's life was brought to public attention for the first time. It can be argued that today's public fascination with the royals began then. The jury found against the prince with a fine of £13,000 in damages, which would be £1.8 million today. Harry asked his brother the king for the money, who in turn wrote to Prime Minister Lord North, requesting that the funds come from the civil list, the taxpayer. North agreed, and the amount was paid to Baron Grosvenor. Harry abandoned Henrietta, but continued his notoriety by subsequently marrying a commoner, against the wishes of the king. This led directly to the passing of the Royal Marriages Act of 1772, whereby any marriage of a member of the royal family requires the consent of the monarch. Although now much smaller than when the lovers stayed there, Henrietta's room, overlooking Holywell Hill, bedroom 8 remains today, with its oak panelling and large open fireplace, the light from which allowed Matthew Stevens to peer inside. Although Baron Grosvenor won damages, the couple were legally separated, not divorced. Neither could marry until the other died. The Baron died in 1802 with debts of over £100,000, £8 million. A month later, Henrietta remarried. Sadly, she was shunned by polite society until her death in 1828, always haunted by her past as the Scarlet Woman at the centre of the royal scandal of St Albans.
Hello, I'm Deborah. Ahead of a Tate exhibition exploring Van Gogh's links with Britain, India Payne charts a little-known fact. Van Gogh's sister lived in Welwyn, and Vincent walked 100 miles to visit her. March 2019 will see the opening of a major exhibition at Tate Britain, bringing together the largest group of Van Gogh's paintings shown in the UK for nearly a decade. Van Gogh and Britain will explore the links between the Dutch-born painter and this country and how it prompted him to discover new avenues in life and art. If you didn't know Vincent spent time in England, you will be more surprised that the Hertfordshire village of Welwyn plays a role in that story. In 1873, aged 20, Vincent arrived in London from Holland. A junior clerk, he was transferred to the London offices of Hague-based international art dealer Goupil & Company, where his uncle was a partner in the firm. As with much of his life, it is through Vincent's letters to his brother Theo that we learn of his impressions, namely that he thoroughly enjoyed the English way of life and the city. He found lodgings in a suburban boarding house and began to explore the city and its surroundings, falling in love with the countryside and parks and walking for miles to explore them. He wrote to Theo, "The countryside here is magnificent, completely different from Holland or Belgium. Everywhere one sees splendid parks with tall trees and shrubs where one is allowed to walk." June 13, 1873. Alex Farquharson, director of Tate Britain, says the impact of this new country was profound on the artist. His stay in Britain changed his vision of the world and himself, encouraging him to become an artist. In August, Vincent found cheaper lodgings in Brixton, where he boarded with Ursula Lawyer and her daughter Eugenie, to whom he declared his love and was rejected, bringing on, some art historians believe, a bout of depression. Vincent's sister Anna joined him at the Brixton lodgings the following July. At 19, she came in search of a job. She and Vincent answered advertisements in the newspapers daily, but Anna had difficulty finding work. Soon after Anna arrived, they packed up their belongings and moved into a house on nearby Kennington Road. During this time, Vincent and Anna's relationship became strained, possibly due to Vincent's broken heart. 2 weeks after moving, Anna found a job that would take her out of the city to the countryside. She took up a post teaching French and music at Miss Applegarth's school in Welwyn for £12 a year. She moved into Rose Cottage on Church Street, her teaching taking place in Ivy Cottage on Codicott Road. In October, Vincent was transferred to the Paris branch of Goupil & Company, returning briefly to England the following January to help with a new outlet before returning to Paris. When he was away, he sent packages of chocolates and pictures to Welwyn for Anna and his other sister, Wilhelmine, who had joined her in Welwyn. "Thanks for what you sent. How sweet of you to think of us in this way. Here, chocolate is also thought of as a real consolation." Letter from Anna to Vincent, December 30th, 1875. In April 1876, Vincent was back in England, taking up a position as an assistant teacher at Mr. Stokes' boarding school in Ramsgate. It's thought that Vincent did not paint in England, but in his letters there are mentions of sketches. In Ramsgate, he made two drawings of the View of Royal Road, which he sent to his parents as gifts. On June the 12th, 1876, Vincent set out on foot from Ramsgate to see his sister Anna in Welin. Wilhelmine had returned to Holland. On the 100 or so mile trek, he passed through Canterbury, where he rested for a while and documents the large beech and elm trees near a little pond. He admired the beauty of his walk, detailing his surroundings, the birdsong, but also the overcast weather. Reaching London, where he spent two evenings, he left at 4 in the morning for Welin. He arrived at Rose Cottage at 5 that evening. He wrote to Theo, "I was with our sister and was very glad to see her. She is looking well." June the 17th, 1876. Despite his poverty, Vincent collected around 2,000 engravings from English magazines, and he came bearing gifts for Anna of his favourite pictures. Sandra Kyriakides of the Welin and District History Society said, "I find it very interesting that he bought prints to show his sister and the children, demonstrating his continued love for art." It's believed Vincent only visited on this one occasion. Anna left the same year. He did not stay for long, and after 2 days headed to Isleworth, where he continued teaching. It seems Anna was extremely fond of Welin and the family she lived with. She wrote of her brother's visit, "It was delightful meeting Vincent again, and I am glad he is meeting them here too, for no one can imagine what a happy life I lead here, surrounded by so much love." The thought of Vincent, poor and seeking direction, yet clearly in love with art and the visual world, walking 100 miles to visit his sister in Hertfordshire, is an extremely romantic one. Could there be a sketch of Welin somewhere? Maybe not. But his life, and especially that of his sisters, was, for a short time, bound up with the village. With thanks to Welin and District History Society. And the article is accompanied by many pictures of Van Gogh's works and extracts from some of his letters.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks as ever to all our contributors, including our readers, Hilary, Sarah, Joan and Liz. And as ever, thank you for listening. Steve will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme, but that's all from me, Bill Redway, in January 2019. We close with Solasta's tune, Reels. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.